Well, hey everybody, and welcome back to Ghouls in the House. I'm Arnold T. Blumberg.
And I'm Natalie Litovsky.
And this is our second episode of the year.
We're doing great, I think, for this year.
Everything's going great. Anyway.
Look at us getting stuff done.
So, we decided since we usually focus most in October, and we always, at the very least, want to have something around Halloween, that we were going to do some stuff. And there's a lot of episodes you guys didn't get.
And might still get.
Some of which we might circle back to. At one point, we watched one of my old favorites, Captain Kronos, which I definitely want to do at some point. But we'll have to watch it again.
Oh.
And K-pop Demon Hunters, we were going to do that. Short version, we liked it. There were a number of other things we've done for a while.
We got some stuff on the back burner here.
And I made a lot of episode graphics that didn't get used.
But it doesn't mean they won't.
Yeah, I mean, that's
we,
true.
We watch a lot of movies and we like talking to you all. We just, you know, this year, the energy conservation mode.
Look, we're all just
here.
For those of you that are still listening, hopefully you'll enjoy this. So we were going to do... Also, this has transformed a little bit, mainly so that we don't go insane.
Insaner, but
because
yes.
We've done in the past, if some of you have been with us for when we did Doctor of the Dead, and then we started doing Ghouls in the House, we've done stuff where we've looked at series we like, and could still wind up doing that again. I'd still like to do Phantasm stuff. We did the Halloween movies.
Scream, obviously.
And we did the Scream movies. And for a while there, oh, that was another thing. We did this. We were going to do the Final Destination series, which we've seen multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Three most of all. And we were also going to do Urban Legend. And we actually watched those because you hadn't seen the Urban Legend. Well, we still might go back to that. But look, again, hanging on by our fingernails. So... we finally got around to watching Final Destination Bloodlines, the latest sequel in the Final Destination series, and basically the latest version of a sort of legacy requel.
Yeah, it's sort of in continuity reboot.
Reboot, sort of. But not because it really...
Mythology retcon,
all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we decided the best thing we could do was, instead of start talking about all the different films, we were going to focus on Bloodlines and use it as a way of looking back at the franchise as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
William John Bloodworth, but my friends call me JB. I've been waiting for you. So, which one of you is next?
And overall, leading off, we enjoyed this one a great deal, actually. I think this was one of the most nicely made movies I've seen in general in a long time, where everyone in the cast was... the acting was excellent. The storytelling and pacing was excellent. The film looked good, like visually, had some beautiful directorial transitions. It was a good movie.
I was honestly most pleasantly surprised by the complete lack of shaky cam.
There was some. But
maybe it was so smooth that even I didn't notice it. Because if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I'm extremely sensitive to it. There are some movies where I've literally only been able to watch maybe 20-30% of the movie while Arnold described the rest to me because I got so motion sick.
There was one of the scenes in the house where they're all sitting around and talking.
Yeah.
The camera was doing that thing of moving around. And I even said to you at one point, I wish they would lock the camera down. But they didn't do it a lot. And I think you got so into it that you didn't even notice the few times they did. But they were doing it a little
bit. Maybe because it wasn't like in action sequences where there's also flashing lights and like other motion. And it worked okay.
I wish they would let go of that aesthetically entirely.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a lot.
Yeah.
And then also when it did become an action sequence, like the huge opening Skyview thing.
Yeah.
It was shot very nicely. And
yeah. I mean, honestly, I fully agree. It is the best looking Final Destination movie we've ever seen. And not just because, oh, it's the most recent, right? They have the best technology, more HD cameras or whatever. No.
As we've talked about a lot of recent stuff looks worse than earlier technology.
Absolutely. So. Like a lot of times they just try too hard to create things artificially and then make everything look cheapened. And this really didn't do that, even though there was very obviously a fair amount of like CGI or whatever you call effects these days. Do we still call it CGI?
Some of it is CGI, yeah.
I mean, not everything was practical is what I'm saying, but...
Although I think they did use some practical stuff.
And I mean, you can tell it's a nice blending.
Yeah.
You know, like some stuff, it's very obvious where you watch it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, the computer did that. But like here, it kind of, you can suspend your disbelief a bit.
And also, as far as significance is concerned, well, also, this was a huge hit. And they've already been talking, as we're recording, I've already read articles about who they're assigning to be, like, director of the next one. I mean, that's the problem. It's a huge success. They didn't even, I don't think they were even prepared for how much. And now it's like, well, let's just churn out more. But, of course, that's the way this always works.
So I think maybe before we fully launch into it, to sort of take it back to my first impressions, when I heard they were making Bloodlines, I was very skeptical because, again, perhaps we should say it one more time, full spoilers ahead if you've never seen Final Destination movies, although I think you probably can guess what they're like. But the first set of Final Destination movies that were made, there are five films in the series, and some of them are better than others, but... the way the story moves from movie to movie and like closes a loop at the end of it, and it feels complete. When you get to the end of the fifth movie, you think Final Destination feels complete.
Yeah, not all as a of them, series. Not all of them may have been like total gems, but they did a nice job of always having either thematic or visual or audio or bits and pieces that tied all the films together. And then five gave you that great thing of saying, ah, guess what? This whole thing has always been a loop and you never knew it. And personally, I think five, isn't five the one where you don't know that it's in the past until the end?
Until the end.
And they did a nice job if you go back, although I'm sure it's not perfect. They do a nice job in five of making you think you're watching a movie in whatever it was at the time. I'm actually looking it up. Mid-2000s. 2011.
Yeah.
But it had to be further back. And I'm sure they made sure as much as possible, like the car models are correct.
There's older
the
cars. Yeah. One of the women, somebody like says she's got like a Lisa Loeb look.
Yeah. And know? It's like, if you're paying attention, you notice it's very nice.
Flip phones.
And like you said, it basically sealed off the series, and you could say, that feels complete, the story's over.
Yeah.
And then they decided to bring back the series with six.
Right, so they're like, well, we're bringing another one in, and I'm like, oh, I don't know, because a lot of times you think, well, can't you just leave well enough alone?
Yeah.
You got mostly okay movies in your series. We tend to not revisit four so much. Four is, I think, probably the weakest.
I think we both agree we like three the most.
Yeah, we like three the most. We find it most rewatchable.
And I think the cast is one of the best casts in the whole run. And ironically enough, it's the one that Tony Todd isn't in.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, voice-wise,
although you
he
hear
is.
Him, but... and yes, that's the other thing. We'll talk about Tony Todd back again for Bloodlines. The sort of heart and soul of the series coming back to to wrap it up again.
So yeah. I was not sure what I was going to get going into it, right? Like, we heard a lot of buzz. People loved it when it was in the theater. We were waiting for it to come to home release, but also we've seen plenty of things in the past that got a lot of buzz, and then we watch it and we think, what were they thinking?
I mean, 9 times out of 10 these days, most of the things that are the hot new horror movie, either I see it or I read enough about it to think, I don't know what the hell people are seeing in this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of it you start to realize, oh, maybe I'm just getting older. And some of it is like, no, taste change and And we've talked a lot about on the show what we've grown to understand that we like and don't like mm-hmm. in horror, which is like weird choices. We've talked about a lot of these things, the kinds of physical attacks we can take and not take in a horror story. And for me, the thing about the Final Destination movies is I'm not usually, and I think I've talked about it on the show too, I've often talked about how I will judge people who seem to be obsessively focused on the kills in a horror series. I mean, like, yeah. if that's all you're watching it for, I'm a little concerned about you. But I will say, this is the one series I think I appreciate that for, because to me, and obviously to many and the people making it, really ultimately when it comes down to it, the Final Destination movies are like a big Looney Tunes cartoon. It's
a Looney Tunes where everyone dies.
Yeah, but it's silliness. And like a lot of the classic Looney Tunes stuff, I'm just hearing like Carl Stalling music in my head, is like Rube Goldberg devices. Mm-hmm. And you'd like Daffy or Bugs, and it'd be like a big factory, and you'd hear Stalling's music going.
Yeah.
And that's what Final Destination is. It's like the bare structure to say, we know ultimately this is all just a silly joke. Let's watch people die in really silly ways. It's not serious. You know, it's just goofy. And as much reality as they bring to the visual effects, the deaths are always done like a cartoon. And so you can laugh at them. And I laugh at them in these because, like, you're supposed to. This is ridiculous.
Also, for the most part, except for a few exceptions in the series, these are deaths that are happening to people. It's not like watching a slasher movie where you're watching a figure or a person actively attack another person.
That's an excellent point that I hadn't thought of.
It like takes you one step removed from it. A good example is there's one of the scenes in 3 where they're in a gym and like the camera is panning around frantically, right? While all the characters who feel like they've figured out the formula are looking around trying to convince the guy who's about to get it that like he's next on the list. And, like, you see everything happening, like a leaking water fountain and people punching a giant taxidermied bear mm-hmm. and, like, these swords.
Like scimitars.
Yeah,
like,
rattling yeah. on the wall while he's just, like, doing bro-y jock stuff and screaming and, like, using the machines. And then he uses the machine, like, slams it. The swords fall off the wall and, like, go whoosh right past him and, like, he doesn't die. And he's like, yeah. And then like goes to do it again. But the swords cut the equipment he's on and his head gets completely smashed. Right.
Right.
And it's like, it's such a feeling of being involved in the process. Like mm-hmm. it's like an audience participation of like pointing out the things that could happen. It's like a highlights puzzle or something, like trying to guess which is the thing that's going to actually happen. So I agree that there is weirdly something kind of goofy about it, and so I think that's why there's something about these movies that just kind of bring people back to them, especially as like a casual watch.
And yet also one of the things we said about this one in particular is it has one of the nicest casts of characters of any of them, and I mean that in both ways. The cast itself, I've rarely seen such a good across the board set of performances in any movie. It's just, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was just the time we watched it, but they really all seem to be dialed in.
The ensemble was clicking.
Early on, the lead, who I need to look up her name again.
We're going to have to look up everyone's name, by the way, because we've never seen any of these actors before.
Which also helped.
It really did.
You know, the lack of, until Tony Todd, which is all you need
right.
as far as recognizability. Caitlin Santayana or Juana, I don't know how it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
She plays Stephanie Reyes, and she in the beginning of the movie, does some of the best driving acting I have ever seen.
It's and a big pet peeve of ours.
We've talked a lot about, like, one of the worst, most egregious things in movies and television is how all the actors that drive are always constantly looking over at the person they're talking to for, like, long beats. Like, they would have crashed into 50 different people at that point. And yes, I get it. They're being pulled by another car, or they're in a process car and they're not moving. But still, act like you're driving the damn car, you know? And I never see anybody do that. And she genuinely acted as if she was driving, paying attention, but talking to somebody the way you actually do it. Sadly, later in the movie, the one playing the mother goes back to old-fashioned acting, driving acting. But
maybe it's generational.
That got me. And I'm thinking, like, it's that little touch that was really nice.
And I think maybe part of what helped it along is that, unlike any of the other Final Destination movies, this one centers entirely on one family. It's unusual. Usually it's
like a friend group.
Yeah, or a group of strangers, right? In the first one, it's all people in the same high school French class. In the second one, it's all people who were about to get onto a highway at the same time.
Oh, that's right.
The third one, it's another high school class who are, you know, having their exciting, fun, like, carnival day before graduation. So you got two high school classes. The fourth one, just a random assemblage of people and friends, adults, kids alike, who were at, like, a local car racing event.
I like that opening of that.
The opening's
the movie's not great.
And then the fifth one are all coworkers, like all adults coworkers who are about to go on a work retreat.
That's the bus on the bridge. Okay.
So they're all either vaguely connected by, like, geography or workplace or school, but there's only, I think, one other set of family members, which is three. You have a pair of sisters who both got, like, spared from the incident and are both on the hit list for death in the third one.
But then, of course, the switch to making it a family not only makes for a tight-knit group, but it also feeds into the actual theme of the movie, which we'll get to in a minute. But while I forgot to mention, the other thing I was saying before about the cast being great is also that the characters are all great. Like, usually there's some, like, rotten person who's decided to, like, work this. So even in three, we get that a little bit. But
we got archetypes.
But almost everybody to a person in this movie is a likable person caught up in this thing, but plays as, like, a decent person. Like, they're all good people.
Yeah.
And I really like the fact that it was such a nice range of characters, and the people playing them were very invested in doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the big thing is that, like you said, the series had pretty much closed itself off with a loop. How the hell do you get back into that? And this movie came up with, I thought, a brilliant, very logical retcon that basically sets up an event from far earlier in the timeline than the previous five, and suggested that everything we've ever seen in all the other movies were people who descended from or were connected by blood to the people saved in this original inciting incident at the beginning of this film in the past. And then we're following the family bloodline of the people left from that, who are the last ones for death to mop up in order to get everything back to the way it was supposed to be when that Skyview restaurant at the beginning of this was supposed to blow up and kill everybody. Great way to tie in all the past films.
And I will say, at first, I still, like, felt like there were some holes in that as a construct. Because, for example, like, it can't fully be going down bloodlines because, like, the kids in the first Final Destination movie, the ones that survived the plane crash, their parents are still alive. Like, they're not killed. And then it occurred to me that...
But we don't know. Maybe they have been.
But again, it's sort of, we've talked about how one of the amusing things in all of this is, even though death seems to be this all-powerful force, death also has to, like, follow all these weird rules of like, can't just be like, ugh, everybody is like just gonna fall down dead who was supposed to die. Okay, we're done.
Yeah, why wouldn't you just do that?
But no, gotta like push some things around here and there until things fall into place. So my thought is that he was like making sure that people in these bloodlines were involved in already scheduled disasters that were happening. And so the like plots of the other movies, for example, like the kids in the first one who get off the plane, they weren't necessarily descended from the bloodlines of this Skyview incident. They went through their own little mini side problem because they were supposed to be part of the plane disaster. And you could argue some of the people from the Skyview incident bloodlines were on the plane.
Yeah. So in other words, we don't necessarily know directly all the characters that were involved.
Exactly.
Right.
That's the only way it works in my head.
But again, it ultimately, I thought it comes across very nice. There's genuine thought put into mm-hmm. this. The storytelling I thought was very nicely structured, which is also a rarity. I felt like you get the information you get, lays it out. And if there are gaps or things that don't quite work, it is still ultimately a Looney Tunes cartoon. So it's like, I'm fine with. And the thing is, they give themselves the get out, which is they make the point of when you start like screwing around with death, things get messy. Mm-hmm. And basically that's the deliberate screenwriter's thing of saying, look, if I missed anything, or if anything doesn't quite work, remember that this is
It's messy. Not an exact science.
And it's like, okay, that's fine. You know, and by the way, I did want to bring this up. Final Destination Bloodlines is credited to two screenwriters. Mm-hmm. One is Laurie Evans Taylor, about whom I am just in a cursory initial thing. I didn't start looking really before doing this. Found nothing. So I don't know who she is. She could have an extraordinary pedigree, but she also doesn't have like a link on Wikipedia. So
gotcha.
But the other person is Guy Busick, who is best known for his collaborations with the radio something Olpin and Bettinelli, Olpin and Gillett, the ones who did Ready or Not.
Okay.
So, and the modern screams.
Ooh.
So Busick wrote Stand Against Evil, Ready or Not, Scream 5,
ooh,
Scream 6.
Oh, no.
He's currently co-writing Scream 7 and the Ready or Not sequel.
No.
And he also wrote Abigail, which we didn't think was so bad, and we covered that in a previous episode, and he wrote this. So what's interesting to me is we have not liked a lot of things this guy has been involved with.
No.
This one I thought really clicked nicely.
And I'm going to give credit to Laurie.
Yeah, I mean, it's Laurie or it's everyone else involved that took whatever, you know. This movie has to do the tricky thing of undoing the loop in the sense of getting the story going again. It introduces a new MacGuffin that I think, if they're thinking the way we think they're thinking, is probably how they're going to continue going forward, because they've never had this before. That's the other thing, is that it's changed over the years. The series is not consistent. For instance, when we watched them all with the intention of talking about them, I remember we noticed that the early movies really focused on the wind coming up whenever death was around, and then they kind of dropped that. This one brought the wind back, which we thought was really a nice touch.
You can tell which Final Destination movies were the favorites of the writers. Two and three were the favorites of the writers
Early on, two things happened right at the beginning of the movie that struck me. The wind was back.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the other thing was somebody took a picture and the sound of the camera going off was the explosion sound every time the pictures were taken in three. And so I was like, oh, okay. So there's like visual cues, things like that. And but the MacGuffin now is a penny, which was present at the original Skyview restaurant incident, which is really a great sequence. And I love how she undoes it. The girl is the centerpiece who becomes like the matriarch of our bloodline, how she undoes it. But the penny is clearly going to continue and seems to carry the curse in some sense.
It's also worth noting that this is the only Final Destination movie where we're not seeing a premonition of something that's going to happen directly to the characters that we're following in the film. So like it all starts like back in the 1960s with this incident where something that sort of looks like the Space Needle and it's meant to be this like sort of atomic age style restaurant, and you know, woman's gonna get proposed to and tell her boyfriend that she's pregnant and everybody's happy and wonderful, and then there is like the worst child in the world, like bad seed like situation where he stole a penny from the fountain at the base and God told us bad luck, and then brought it up top and hurled it off the tower, even though the security guard was like, don't do that, like it's dangerous. And he was like, yeah, okay, sir, of course, and like throws the penny off, and like the penny goes back into a vent, and like everything starts sort of cascading from there.
Oh, and they kill the kid eventually, and we were very happy
in the premonition part. Yeah,
yeah, the premonition.
I mean, it's like this all happens, right, and she completely like stops it, the whole thing from happening. She rips the penny out of the kid's hand so he can't throw it, so it doesn't go in the vent to start the whole thing that causes the tower to collapse, even though the dance floor, class dance floor in this giant tower that was built in record time ahead of construction deadlines, bad idea. And, you know, she comes in running, gets everybody off the dance floor before it cracks, and nobody dies in it, you know, in the situation. And it also, it almost felt extra Looney Tunes when she stopped it. Like, she grabs the penny, runs inside, throws a dish over a flambé.
It like, definitely almost felt like it was being done more like comedy, where you do the thing where you're like following up on everything that you just saw. She's running around fixing everything,
and like as they're dragging her like off the stage, or everybody's running before they realize the glass cracks, she like looks down the hallway and smiles at like little kid version of Tony Todd, right, who's sitting there, because she's seen the vision already where she's like trying to save him from like dying in this tower collapse, and she's like, hey, kid's okay. And it's like such a weird feeling, but that whole premonition then like becomes a situation where it's actually a recurring nightmare of our POV character in the present, and she's trying to figure out what the hell is it, why is she having this nightmare every time she goes to sleep. And it's like, this is such a strange shift from what they normally do.
And of course, you mentioned the kid, the mini Tony Todd. After all these years of trying to figure out who he is, and the movies definitely suggested, or at least some people involved in the movies wanted us to kind of pick up on the possibility that he may be the personification of death itself, that maybe he's kind of there, or he's something. And as it turns out in this, I mean, obviously this is being done after the fact to explain him, but it turns out he's the son of a singer who was there, who also is very kind to our lead character. So she's pregnant. She hasn't told the boyfriend yet, you know. That's what won me over immediately, by the way, too. She didn't know how he was going to react. And he's like, this is awesome. I'm thinking, boy, everybody in this is going to be good. and then we find, so we find out Tony Todd was a little boy there. And as he himself tells us later, basically everything that we've ever seen of him later is because he'd been working with her over the years to figure out the larger plan and try to help people and help themselves in how to make sure this didn't happen.
And he was like the last to go in the premonition, apparently.
In the original
premonition.
Even
after our like main character's grandma, who's the one who stopped it all.
And that's another aspect of this that I definitely do not offer as a criticism, because we enjoyed this movie a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting in that this was a sequel done long after the series had wrapped up, like a lot of these things are. We always call them legacy sequels now. Although, well, this one brings back Tony Todd, so there's someone who's actually genuinely present from the originals. And the idea was to try to figure out a new way forward with this story. And it's interesting to me that it feels very much like, despite the fact that there's no other real reasons to look in that direction necessarily, except success, it very much feels like they looked at Halloween 2018 and thought, let's do some of that. Because when you watch this, the character at the beginning that we see as a young woman is the grandmother of our lead character, who's having the dreams of her grandmother's experience at the Skyview. And we find out that her family considers the grandmother to be a psychotic. She's become like a prepper doomsday nut who's hidden away in a cabin in the middle of the woods with floodlights and gates everywhere.
Who had her children taken away from her by the state when they were younger because she was just obsessed with protecting them from death.
And who has a speaker system set up outside the gate where she tells people to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And she has long, you know, white hair and books and notes and, you know, all kind of weapons and everything. And she's Laurie Strode from Halloween 2018. And we also meet the other generations, like we meet the three generations of Strode women in Halloween 2018.
Yep.
And in that one, we focused on, I forget her name, I think it's Andy Matichek, but I can't remember for sure, the one who played the granddaughter. This is basically focusing on that character too.
Yep.
And her finally learning the truth about what her grandmother went through and facing down death.
And that it's all actually real and not just family legend.
Yeah, it's all Halloween 2018. It even leads up to the grandmother's house blowing up and burning down at the end. I mean, really, honestly,
yeah.
You can't. And the thing is, I don't know if they've said anything in any interviews. Maybe they wouldn't want to. But you can't tell me they didn't watch Halloween 2018 just go, let's do that bit and that character structure and that finale, but we'll shoehorn in Final Destination stuff, which I think they do well.
Yeah.
And as even you pointed out, there was an aspect of shifting the perspective that you just described to the granddaughter that almost gave it a Nightmare on Elm Street kind of opening as well, because it's nightmares that she's having
yeah.
the whole time. But it's mainly Halloween 2018 with Final Destination stuff put into it. And I mean, honestly, I think it works. It works, but it feels obvious that's where they got it from.
Well, not only that, but you can see a lot of sort of fingerprints of other films in there. Like when I mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street, it's because she just can't sleep. Like she's nodding off on the drive home from college because she can't sleep. She just keeps having this nightmare about this woman. She can't understand who she is.
Yeah, you said they need to give her some hypnocell.
Give her some hypnocell. We're good. But I think it also, I mean, since we watched it recently and it was the last movie we talked about, has a little touch of I Know What You Did Last Summer, where in the beginning of it, have Jennifer Love Hewitt coming home from college because she's like racked with so much guilt and she's not sleeping and she's failing her classes and she's on academic probation because she's like not understanding like how to deal with like all of the guilt of what they've been through. And there's a feeling of that too, because she's having these nightmares. She's not doing well in classes. They put her on probation. She's going to lose her scholarship. That's the plot of I Know What You Did Last Summer.
There's
a lot of things you could sort of touch on to say like, oh, I can see this movie or that movie in it. But I don't think that necessarily is a bad thing.
In this case.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, it's like there are times we could put these things out and say that's all in service to what becomes a bad movie and that the movie itself doesn't take those elements and do anything with them. I think this one does. And it was a very nice adaptation of some of those things.
Yeah. I mean, basically they picked out parts of other films that worked and kind of wove them into the formula for a Final Destination movie. And then we ended up with this.
Also, in keeping the idea, we don't really know if we can credit the writer at all. Who knows? It's two guys that directed it. And if they weren't first timers, they're close to it. I think one of them was an editor. Which then also makes me think, based on what I'm about to say, I'm thinking, well, maybe it was the cinematographer or somebody else on set that did. Because this not only looks good.
Yeah.
There are some really nice artistic transition shots and angles in this movie. These two guys are either some of the cleverest first time or novice directors I've ever seen take over a series, or they had a great DP or somebody who said, do this, or the editor, or somebody. There's that great shot I wanted to mention. There's a transition shot of the broken glass floor at the sky view that goes into her eye. And it's just a beautiful scene. And it also has one of the most fluid transitions to a flashback I've seen in a long time, where Tony Todd is telling us we're going back to the sky. We revisit that sequence several times to fill things in. We revisit it from his perspective when our characters find him. And basically, like in the second act, he gets to drop all the exposition. And he says, you know, I was there. And he's playing with a toy train, and the toy train rolls away and just rolls straight into the flashback in his hands as a kid. It's a beautiful shot. I don't know who did it or who's responsible for them, but they're great shots in this movie.
And I think maybe that's one of the things that surprised us the most. Like, you know, no shade to the Final Destination series. We enjoy it, but a lot of the movies are not what I would call, say, like, high art. I mean, and nor do they have to be.
No.
But a lot of them just sort of feel like we're just going frame by frame through the story that they're telling. And quite a few of them really just feel like you're biding your time until the next Rube Goldberg machine of death.
I still felt like that for this, because that's what you're watching it for on a certain level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also it had some interesting, like, some interesting switcheroos and, you know, gotchas. And, oh, you think this is where it's going? Well, it's not going there. And I appreciate that, because we've not had that so much in the series.
The one scene where the family has gotten together and she's trying to convince them, and they're trying to figure out who the next one is. And just organically, as a part of that whole debate, conversation, they're disbelieving her. They all find out that the one son is not the father's biological son. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was just such a beautiful, like I said at the beginning, they're all good characters. You like this family.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, there's some genuine real human drama that comes as a result of this insanity of death creating Rube Goldbergs to take out a family. It was a beautiful touch that gave a great twist for, you'd think you know what's going on, but not. But very nicely done.
It also was a great, like, repetition callback scene, because it was the second time that the family was all assembled in the living room.
That's right.
So the first time is after the grandmother dies, and it feels, everyone else is like, oh, it's just a freak accident. But, like, the grandma literally wrote in her book how she was gonna die, handed the book to the grandkid and was like, fine, I'm stepping outside, like, seeing's believing.
Yeah,
and, like,
she just sacrificed, you know,
she
herself.
Had cancer and felt like, well, I'm just gonna take myself out. The fact that, like, that happened and she's the only witness, and now she's fully on board and she's piecing together all the notes. She's got it up on the wall. It's like the meme that everyone shares with all the conspiracy strings.
It's a neat new version of the meme.
Yeah. And they have that scene after her uncle dies.
Yeah.
So it's like there was another big family barbecue, amazing Rube Goldberg series. You keep thinking, like, a shard of glass is going to take somebody out a different way. And
they
then
do
it
a lot
doesn't.
Of misdirects.
Yeah. Like
too.
One of the girls is choking and you think, oh, did she swallow it? No bug. And, like, you think,
I also
at
one point she and some of them are, like, trying to figure out what around them is going to be the Rube Goldberg. Like, they figured out that's the craziness. So.
Yeah. And, like, her mother, who has, like, abandoned them and then, like, shown back up for the funeral of her mother. You know, she's also looking around, because much like in Halloween 2018, like, her mother had trained her to look for these signs.
She's the Judy Greer character.
Right. And so, like, they're bouncing on a trampoline. Her brother's about to get on there. She's like, wait. And she goes and takes, like, a hoe out from underneath of it and puts it back in the toolbox. But incidentally, it being in the toolbox is then what causes the Rube Gold. It's genius.
We should mention also that, like, there are great, you know, if you are watching it for that, and as I said, this is one series where I allow myself that that's what we're doing. There are some truly great ones, most of which you couldn't watch.
I don't do body horror very well.
So, and I mean, we've talked enough about it. There's stuff I don't handle well. This time is fine, because for me, Final Destination is just, it's so stupid. it works for me that like I can watch it.
Yeah. But just to finish that through line is like after that whole backyard, Rube Goldberg is where her uncle, our POV character, her uncle dies because he's the older kid. And so she calls that first family meeting to tell them, based on like what looks like an absolutely insane chart on the wall, of like explaining it all and saying, okay, now cousins, it's going to go in birth order and you're all next. And basically everyone treats her like she's just as crazy as their grandmother was, and they all leave. And it's the second meeting where she's like, I really thought I had it figured out, guys. Like, I don't understand how I was wrong, because it was a different cousin who dies first. And that's when the mother, like her aunt, steps in and is like, no, you had it right. You just didn't have all the information, but I didn't tell you because I didn't believe you that this was a thing. And, you know, your cousin you thought was going to get it first is not actually your uncle's son. And like, that's what kind of sets off, you know, a different chain of events.
It's interesting, too. Two things I wanted to bring up from your reference to the sort of conspiracy meme. Instead of red strings, it's like she's pulled all the pages out of her grandmother's book. And it basically looks like red tape, but it looks like she's done like this extended family line of all the people that come down from Skyview through to whatever.
Right.
But it also kind of looks to me like red highways. And I love the fact, by the way, that they visually carry that into the opening of the ending credits with the penny rolling forward. And it had the same sort of kinetic, like propulsive feel to me at the end that I loved from the end of the first new Planet of the Apes movie, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where we're at the airport at the end, and then you start seeing the tracking lines of the airplane, the flights out that are taking plague everywhere. And I thought the penny rolling through all the red things as the credits start was a great way of signaling, even if they hadn't necessarily thought, but I'm sure they did, that's like, we're going to keep going with this now. The other thing I wanted to bring up was that as you described it, it suddenly occurred to me the part where she's like, I don't have all the information. She was trying to assemble a map, a plan of connecting lines, but she was wrong because the one kid wasn't the father's biological kid. Is very similar to the big twist change up at the end of a book I've been reading now every year for October, A Night in the Lonesome October. And there's a character in it, the dog Snuff, who has to figure out lines of connection between players in a game that's going to happen Halloween night. But one of the key twists in the book is he doesn't have all the information, and the network, the pattern is incorrect. And that's exactly the same thing here. She thought she had assembled a pattern, but there was a piece that was out of place.
Yeah.
Same thing, which I really like. So, yeah. And by the way, that's another thing that's become an annual tradition as I read that. I discovered that a lot of people read that every year in October, and it's a wonderful addition to the October experience to read that book. Roger Zelazny. So, anyway. I was going to say also earlier, and it interrupted you when you were still doing your thought, it's like, obviously this has set pieces. There is a garbage truck sequence. It's very good. I think the showstopper of this movie is the MRI machine.
I think everybody seems to think that.
Which is very good. I also love the interplay with the two brothers and the peanut butter allergy and the way they work that in. And that guy is so sweet. And there's always people in these that don't deserve to die, but I think this movie has the highest number of characters I didn't feel deserved to die, right up to including the end of the film.
Yes.
Which I did not agree with and almost kind of knocked me off of liking it, but I still like it a lot. And I have to accept that if I treat it like a cartoon, I can't be that precious about the ending. So,
I mean, I do like that our sweet summer child got to taste a peanut butter cup before he died.
And really liked it because they're awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's amazing effect stuff. And like you said, a very good blend of what looks like some practical stuff with CGI blood never is good. But it wasn't that bad in this. It was done pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was also so impressed with so many aspects of it that I was predisposed to let it go on a few things that I wouldn't ordinarily care for.
Yeah, I think so.
But I think we should talk about Tony Todd.
It's hard to talk about Tony Todd.
Tony Todd, I mean, I'm sure if not everybody, most people listening to this know Tony Todd. He's a legend in the horror community, obviously. Most people are going to think probably initially of Candyman, which is probably one of his greatest roles, playing Candyman in the original films and returning when they did a legacy sequel, coming back. But he's been in Tom Savini's 1990 remake of Night of the Living Dead. He's great in that. And he's done tons of other horror movies. Plenty of things he's been in that are far worse than him. You know, he's always the best thing in a lot of the things he's done. Because also you get to that point, like a lot of people like him, where you get a lot of younger generations of filmmakers who meet them at conventions all the time, desperately want them to be in their terrible iPhone shot movie. And they'll do it because they'll take a paycheck and they'll take the job. And so you'll get Tony Todd show up in some guy's like vampire epic or whatever. And it's terrible. But Tony Todd will always give it 110%.
Mm-hmm.
And for Star Trek fans, he's all over that because he was Worf's brother Kern on both Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and always wonderful. But perhaps I think more emotionally significant, and you did see it, is he plays the older Jake in the Deep Space Nine episode, The Visitor, where we see an alternate future where Ben Sisko died.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake realizes eventually his death is the only thing that'll bring his father back. Beautiful story. He has to carry the whole episode. And he was also on Voyager in an alien role. He came back and played another character in Voyager. So he's all over the place. And to fans of Final Destination, he was the one recurring figure as Bloodworth through the entire series. And except for three, turned up in every movie. And even in three, although we didn't get to see him, they incorporated his voice in like the Devil roller coaster.
Yeah,
so,
he's like the ride's voice.
So in a way, the presence of Tony Todd is there. And so you'd think, well, you're not going to move forward and do a new Final Destination without Tony Todd. Except that at the time they finally got around to doing it, he was dying. And as often happens with people dying of cancer, there's that point a person gets to where they look like they're not even there. They look like there's so little of their physical self there.
Yeah.
And he had to shoot his scene like on the cusp of death, basically. And it's bizarre because it's a silly little series, but the series is all about death. And here's Tony Todd, who's always played this sort of mortician character, who, like I said, is always sort of kind of like, there's always been a bit of this question, which this resolves as this is not the case of like, is he connected to death? Is he? And here he shows up in this when our lead characters find out he's the one that was at the Skyview with her grandmother. And he's basically the one that gets to provide all of the exposition. Here's how you can avoid it. There are only two ways to avoid it that mm-hmm. we've seen in the past. Reference to Final Destination 2 that sets up the ending of this movie, and as you pointed out, definitely one of the ones they liked a lot. But then the thing is that he was so ill that apparently everybody on set that day, he does one scene, he does it in one set, he looks horrible, but he doesn't sound terrible.
He sounds like himself.
He's really working on it.
Yeah.
And basically after he does the exposition, he basically reveals that knowing that he was the last in the line, he's expecting to die. And so he's decided, like her grandmother, to kind of take himself out of the equation. And he's packing up and going home and retiring. And it's basically his farewell. And in leaving the room, as anybody who's read about this knows, on the day they basically had a speech written for him, whatever few lines they had. And instead they just told him, knowing that it's his last time on a set, say whatever you want. And so his farewell is Tony Todd coming up with stuff off the top of his head that's actually, like, in a way pretty predictable what you'd expect, but knowing the context makes it extra heavy, of him basically saying, you know, enjoy every day you get. And it was, we couldn't watch it without tearing up a little bit, because you know he's saying goodbye to everybody. And it was beautifully done. It was really beautifully done.
They also found a way to like work in, like in the universe,
oh,
in
right,
movie,
right.
That he was sick.
Yes.
And in a sense, it's like he explains that the same thing was happening to him that was happening to their grandmother before she left the cabin, and that they both had managed to evade for so long that both of them had cancer, because that was just like a last ditch effort to say, well, something's going to take them out eventually.
I love that idea that like death like gave up on all the cartoon gimmicks at one point. It's like, fine, I'm just giving you cancer then. But a brilliant way of working in the reality.
Yeah, because there's no getting around the fact that he's ill
when he's
on the set. But he also just looks, you can tell that he is so happy to be there.
Yeah, he looks
happy.
He
is not doing it like under duress. They didn't drag him out there, you know.
I think he specifically asked that he was, I think he insisted on doing it. Yeah.
You know, and one of the things I think that makes him such a beloved actor for a lot of people is that it is clear in every single role that he's ever taken that, like, he takes it seriously.
Yes.
Like, he commits himself to it and is truly a joy to watch on screen. Like, even when he is ill on screen, you see him and he just lights up the scene, because that's who he was as an actor. It's one of the things that got me super riled up. Not that like award shows mean anything, and every year they leave somebody out of the In Memoriam.
I forgot that.
And they left Tony Todd out of the In Memoriam at the Oscars this year. And it really bothered me, because it's like just another instance of the film industry at large not taking horror seriously as a genre, not taking Black actors seriously as thespians. And it was really frustrating to see that, and to see that they weren't placing some value in memorializing him amongst, you know, a room of fellow actors, many of whom I'm sure expected to see him like on screen in the In Memoriam. Like, sometimes they make an excuse and say, well, someone was primarily a TV actor.
Yeah, that's not the case.
And so, like, you know, maybe they did one big movie or something, but maybe we don't put them up there. But like, they put up every studio accountant. If you're telling me it's because, oh, not enough films, no, that's on that one.
Yeah.
And you know, if it's about timing, absolutely not. So I was in a way kind of, I don't want to say looking forward to, but kind of looking forward to seeing his final performance, because from everything we'd heard from people who'd been to the theater, they kind of really implied that it was sort of him writing his own In Memoriam, really.
Yeah.
And it was, and it's a beautiful scene. It's very touching.
A lot of people found it very cathartic, seeing it. Yeah.
I intend to enjoy the time I have left, and I suggest that you do the same. Life is precious. Enjoy every single second. You never know when.
And yeah. It's a beautiful moment. It's weird. It feels a little weird to see this movie about like people getting folded in half and having their heads smashed open like melons and everything. It's like, but this is a beautiful moment. But it is. It's because it's silliness, and everybody watching and making it knows it's silliness. But the work is real, and his career is real. And, you know, in fact, we just recently got, maybe we'll try to remember to make a note of it next time we talk, but like, you know, we'll be delving deeper and deeper into both familiar and maybe some other new things for Halloween as we get closer. But I had recently bought, they put out a what's supposed to be a beautiful new Blu-ray restoration of that 1990 Night of Living Dead.
Yeah.
which we've discovered in the past watching on streaming has often been the terrible print of it has been, or copy of it is on streaming. The color's all wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm very much looking forward to this because they say not only is it beautiful looking, but it also restores a lot of uncut material that has never been seen mm-hmm. by a lot of us. And I thought this is another reason to watch Tony Todd in that. So
absolutely. You know,
yeah.
So yeah, I think that was a side moment in the film, in that like you have sort of chaos, cartoon, Rube Goldberg, and then you have a moment where everybody just sits still and listens to Tony Todd for a few minutes. And then it just launches into just the most like crazy, huge Rube Goldberg situation that they've had, I think, in any of these. Right after that, it goes like right back to Looney Tunes, which is not a complaint. It's just sort of the movie was like, we're going to take a minute, give everybody a pause, center yourself, because it's going to get weird right after this.
And by the way, you mentioned when they walk in to see Bloodworth, they're like going to like the mortician's place, you know, whatever.
They're in the morgue at the hospital. Yeah.
And they're walking back to the room, which is a huge room, to see him where he's sitting. But like there's another room they go through first where a guy is actually conducting an autopsy on an open body. But he's this weird sort of staring, ghoulish guy who barely acknowledges them as they all walk in, like civilians all walk in past an open corpse while he's working.
And he's like, what are you doing here? They're like, front desk said we could come.
And Bloodworth said, oh, he's through there. And like then, as you pointed out, like Bloodworth and the others are talking about, well, how do we survive getting killed by death? Well, you can kill somebody or you can die yourself and get revived. And you were thinking, like, what's that guy in the other room thinking they're talking about?
His coworker is busy like cutting open a guy's sternum in the next room. And you got like half a dozen teenagers just like hanging out. I guess at this point, not quite that many, unfortunately. Yeah. But you got four left at that point. And they're all like hanging out, and he's like, well, if you kill someone, you take the years they have left. And like, is he just in the other room being like, ah, this again?
I genuinely think so. I think Bloodworth let him in on it a long time ago.
Or is like, is there like a cutscene somewhere where he's like, take five, Hal? And he's like, all right, go for a smoke break. And like, just like walks out. Because he's not there. You don't see them walk past him on the way out. So he vacates the scene at some point. But it's like, what does his coworker think about him trying to explain to a bunch of random strangers how you outsmart death's plan?
And in terms of this movie and the finale in terms of outsmarting death, as I think we mentioned before, is there's a really nice play on a strategy that came up in two, which, as we've said, clearly seems to be one of this group of filmmakers' favorites for drawing elements, because they do a bit of two for the end of this, but give it their own spin, which is good. And the log truck turns up.
As part of a train crash.
So as it's part of a train crash. So it's like
combo 2-3.
Two and three together.
It's a 2-3 punch.
Yeah. And so like, all right, that's good. But you also have, there's the book of the franchise, because when you see the grandmother's book, it's got all the pictures she's drawn of everything that's ever been. So you get that. But the penny has been in that book the whole time, which I feel, like I said before, I feel like is really like their way out for any future story, is the penny will carry forward.
I mean, it's a bit on the nose to say the, like, keeps turning up like a bad penny. It's literally a bad penny. It's
probably what they thought of.
It's very on the nose. Yeah. But it's the penny that's like the Rube Goldberg that sets in motion, like the final of like punctuation on the end of this film, where it's like, you know, siblings think they got past it, but they didn't. And it seems like they imply that like the penny just keeps rolling forward.
I, like you also mentioned, in keeping with the fun we have with this series, with death's bizarre, incredibly ultra complicated approach to solving his problems. Like the part that always comes up at the end where you get like the flash forward 6 months or a year and everything's great and then he's back again. And it's like, so having not succeeded, rather than continue to try the way he does through the whole movie, you're saying that he just goes, to hell with it then, fine. And then like a year later, I forgot, that didn't get those two from the other thing. Maybe I should go back.
Yeah, it's not the first time you see this where it's like however many months later that happens. It happens in one as almost like a scene that they added on at the last minute. They weren't going to do it, but they like added it on. You can tell like they all look different. Oh, they filmed it later. Where the like three survivors go to Paris on the trip they were supposed to take. And then they all get like,
yeah, isn't there like an alternate ending? I think we watched it. I know.
Yeah. There's some like alternate version
three. I know they do it. The flash forward.
The alternate version is bananas crazy where they don't go to Paris. Instead, you find out Claire is pregnant and there's like a baby. Oh,
right. Right. That's, yes.
I'm glad they didn't.
Oh yeah. They did one way. Like verbal reference to Claire in this.
Yeah. So, you know, they have that. In two, our main character is the one that survives that they mention in this
one. They mention her by name.
And the, like, you know, 6 months later, whatever, it's not her getting injured. It's like the kid of a family that was supposed to die in a secondary action that was trying to take out the characters in the first one, who dies in a grill explosion, which is why they kind of telegraph maybe the grill's going to explode in Bloodlines.
They do a nice job of picking up on a lot of iconography from the past films, both to lead into something or to trick you into it.
So three and four both have a sort of a capper on the end with a second premonition.
Right.
In three, it ends with the three surviving characters on the subway that's going to crash. And she has a premonition about that one, but they can't get off before it happens. Four, it's the only thing I think is kind of interesting about four. Four, he has a second premonition about a second disaster and actually manages to stop that second disaster from happening. And like your three survivors now have like another step removed ending where they're sitting in a cafe and then a bus goes through the front window and like takes them all out.
Okay. I remember that.
And five.
Five wraps everything up.
Five wraps everything up and you have one character. Five is where they introduced the idea of you can like take a life and take the years they had left. Mm-hmm. It's the only movie that does that prior to Bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the characters actually does that and finds out at the last minute the guy whose life he took had cancer and was about to die.
Right.
And, you know, he gets taken out by debris from the plane crash.
Very monkey's paw kind of.
Yeah. Thing. So it's like, it's sort of tradition, I guess. It happens in a lot of them. But genuinely, it's like, why wait? And I guess the idea for why wait is it's almost like death has to wait for another disaster. Like, you missed your chance the first time. So now he's just sitting there, like, tapping his foot and, like, twiddling his thumbs and looking at his watch and being like, what's the next nearest disaster that's on the schedule? And how can we, like, adjust it a little bit to take them out? Or it's like, he just likes toying with them and letting them think they're safe so that their guard is down so that he can actually take them out. Or it's like being in timeout and he's got to turn over an hourglass and wait for the sand to go down into the bottom before he's allowed to try again. Like, I don't really know what those rules are.
By the way, you mentioned the ways you can get out of it. I love the two brothers were great for comic relief and also, like, you genuinely still care about them.
Yeah.
But I also love the really extended moment where they both have to convince each other they're not going to do anything to the babies in the hospital. It's like, you know, you take the years they've got left. And they're like, not babies. No, not babies. But no, not doing it. But it takes a minute before they thoroughly let that go.
Which is also kind of a Halloween thing, because I've mentioned it before when we talk about Halloween 2 and how Michael Myers walks right past the neonatal unit and just looks at the babies and are like, ah, they're cool, I guess.
Yeah, and he does that in one of the new ones, too.
As a nod to 2.
I thought you were going to talk about your whole thing about how did the babies all blow up at the end.
Oh, well, I mean, they did. It's unfortunate.
It's not
a very big hospital, and it was a large explosion.
It is a large explosion, but I don't think the babies blew up.
We digress on that one.
Okay.
But
anyway.
They are a great comic relief together.
Final Destination Bloodlines is pretty good. That's what we're saying.
So the real question, I guess, is how are they going to carry this forward? Because basically, I think there's really only one of three options for another film. So option one is that something happens to tie up the loose end of Kimberly being like our lone survivor of the series to have survived fully flatlining and coming back and seems to be fine. And maybe Death decides, you know, this is a loose end that I have to clean up and it goes in that direction. Maybe. Another one would be that it's just basically about the Penny being unleashed on the world. Like now that the Penny is out in the wild, that's the central instigator and part of this that's like setting things in motion, because it's basically just like an unsupervised like death instigator that is like out there in the world. Or the third option is, and to be honest, I kind of hope that they go this third direction with it.
Yeah.
Need a writer, guys? Call me. But I kind of hope they go the direction of JB has a child that he didn't know about. And so technically, that bloodline's actually not done.
Right.
Like you following through his family line, or had a sibling that he didn't know about who then also had kids and their kids had kids. Like there's possibilities basically for his side of the family that either he has a kid or he had a sibling who had kids, etc. And take it the same plot line and basically just keep moving it forward down the line, and they're going to have to find some of his old notes and try to piece together all of this, because it is an exceptionally, like, if not white beige series on the whole. There is not a huge amount of diversity in this one. They tried a little bit in that, like, our main characters, like, our POV character and her brother are meant to be, like, half Filipino, is sort of what we've pieced together. At least,
well, the actors themselves are, and the one playing their father is
Hawaiian, and yeah. So sort of meant to be, like, Pacific Islander in some sense. But
no black friends.
No, I mean, there's no friends at all, because this one's really just the family. Right. Like this is the, I guess, because they decided not to have any additional diversity in the family. It makes no real like range of diversity in the cast. So and that's been a problem in all of the movies. Usually, if there is any character of color, there's one in these movies.
And I mean, the thing is, continuing the Bloodworth thing in some way, I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but I know there are multiple examples in the past of like, I think they did it in Bond kind of with Q a little bit. There's multiple examples in the past of series that have actors and characters that are like so defined with part of it, and then they die, and like they'll do like a thing where this is their last appearance, but then like the next sequel will be like, yeah, but we'll pick up on that by showing a picture of them in a file and say, oh, this is the person that's replacing them. Like they extend the tribute,
right,
to also try to keep them in it in some sense, which is why I like your idea. Makes a lot of sense that like if they want to maintain what has become an iconic aspect of the series, you want a really charismatic black actor in there as a Bloodworth who can carry on for Tony Todd, and having the excuse to bring him up again and say, but like, I'm the son, I'm the brother. And there, I mean, there are a lot of great possibilities for casting for that too, that could carry that forward.
Yeah. And I think the only other way you could potentially do it, which, if he was somebody who his character was meant to be dying of cancer probably isn't likely, but we've never really had a situation in these films before where they've dealt with the topic of organ donation. Like, what happens if part of you lives on in someone else?
Oh my God, that would be quite a twist in one of these.
Yeah, that, like, you know, donate all your organs, they all go to different people and they're all connected.
Oh my God, that's really good.
I know. I'm unemployed right now, by the way, everyone. So if you know someone who would like someone to punch up a script for the next Final Destination movie, give me a call, man.
Thanks for listening to Ghouls in the House, featuring Natalie Bielatowski and Arlt Blumberg. You can find Natalie on Threads and Blue Sky at Positively Natalie, and me at Doctor of the Dead. Our movies this episode were the entire Final Destination franchise from 2000 to 2011, and, oh yes, Final Destination Bloodlines 2025.
For years, people have been coming to me for advice. Well, I'm tired. I'm done with all that.
Ghouls in the House is an ATV Publishing production. Check out our other podcasts, books on your favorite fictional worlds, and other assorted goodies at www.atvpublishing.com.
Good luck.